Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is Andrew Peach with the Happy Pod, where we talk to the people at the heart of the world's positive news stories. First, Tamara in Puerto Rico has an idea. She writes, I love listening to the feel-good stories and the sounds that make people happy, but what if we had the opportunity to guess what they are? Good plan, Tamara. So what is that the sound of? Stay with us. Also on the way in the Happy Pod, we'll hear from Costa Rica, the Philippines, Thailand and France. There's an unusual recipe for cheesecake.
Our machine can pick up one of these ingredients, which we will load into a food cartridge, and then it will just carefully deposit it into a shape that we tell it to.
The happiest place to live.
Half of the year, we are surrounded by a dark slush, and we're okay with that, because the other half, it's great.
And the unexpected sound that listener Paige loves to hear.
When I heard the call for recordings of our favorite sounds, I thought mine is perhaps a bit ASMR, but I knew instantly what it is.
All on the way in the Happy Pod. Let's start, though, in Australia with Megan. Megan breeds hundreds of cows every year at her stud farm at Ripplesbrook in West Gippsland in the state of Victoria. But she's never had one with black and white markings that look like a smiley face. Here she is on ABC Australia.
We've seen some number sevens or love hearts on the head and, you know, a few strange markings, but we've never seen anything that resembles a smiley face before. I actually zoomed in at first to make sure that none of our workers or anything have, you know, added some extra lines or anything. And
I wonder if you've seen the image that's been shared around the world of the calf, now called Happy. Just like Megan, my first reaction was that it must have been photoshopped. Well, Happy's now been sold to the nearby Lardner Park farm, where he's going to be its mascot. I've been talking to the chief executive, Craig Debham.
The reality of the situation was Megan and Barry breed lots of calves. When they posted a very simple photo of the Happy face that Happy has on him, the photo went viral, and as farmers it was quite overwhelming for them. They had this wonderful idea that because he's so unique that they might be able to use it as a fundraising opportunity for our local hospital. And we got wind of that in some of the posts that we saw on social. We're about to launch our big ag field day called Farm World, and we sat with our board very quickly and made the decision that he would be the great poster child, a magnificent mascot for Farm World for many years to come. Farm World has literally been running for about 60 years, so the average age of a cow of Happy's type is about 20, 25 years, so we've got a mascot for the next 20 or 25 years, and he's got 300 acres of beautiful green Gippsland pastures to munch on, which we have available to us. And it's just a great outcome for everybody, I think.
Of course, yeah. Well, but particularly for Happy the calf. And I mean, how do you put a price on it? Because you had to decide, you know, what is this worth to us, I suppose, and you ended up with a figure of $7,000 or $10,000.
We sort of sat with the board and the chairman and said, what do we think he might have gone for if he were auctioned? I think he might have gone for somewhere between $2,000 and $5,000, and it would be hard to tell because, you know, he would have been in a live auction situation. But Lardner Park just wanted to sort of, well, one, surprise Megan and Barry, but as much as anything, the CEO of the local hospital, Dan Weeks. So we just doubled it. You know, we're about to run our big field day. We're in a position where we could make a solid donation to the hospital. So, you know, to blow their socks off, we thought, you know what, we'll throw $10,000 Australian, and as you say, $7,000 US, and we'll buy him. He'll have a happy life because he'll be very well cared for at Lardner Park, and he'll become the mascot for Farm World. We'll have somewhere in the vicinity of 40 or 50,000 people through the gates over the next 3 days, and they'll be admiring him.
Every single one of them is going to have a photo in front of Happy the calf, aren't they?
100%. So if he hasn't gone viral now, mate, he'll go viral definitely at Farm World.
Is he happy? I mean, does he have a happy temperament?
He's a wonderful calf. He really does have a quite calm and happy temperament. He's a ripper.
And just tell me a little bit about Ripplebrook. It's a part of Australia I've not been to. I've been to some of the agricultural bits around Sydney. But tell me a little bit about agriculture in Victoria. What's it like?
A lot of the dairy industry in Australia exists in Gippsland. So beautiful green rolling hills, if you can imagine. Obviously, in the summer, Australia gets hot, but we still have what we call green drought. So we don't get as dry as the rest of the parts of the country, but it's a beautiful part of the world, and Gippsland, it's just a wonderful place to live.
Craig Devon with me. Now, if you're in Victoria and you get a selfie with Happy the Calf, globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. Same email address to share the happy news from your part of the world, or tell us what you think. globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. New York is home of the cheesecake, and now it's home of the 3D printed cheesecake as scientists at Columbia University map out the future of printed food. Jonathan Blutinger is the head chef at their Creative Machines Lab. He told me how it works.
In the same way that you put mustard or ketchup onto a burger or frosting on a cake, it follows a similar type thing where instead of a hand, you know, depositing these pastes onto these different materials, we have a machine doing it. So our machine can pick up one of these ingredients, which we will load into a food cartridge, and then it will just basically carefully deposit it into a shape that we tell it to. So we will hand it a recipe file, and then it will just follow layer by layer, drop off an ingredient, pick up another one, and do this over and over again until it finishes fully multi-material print.
Which is incredibly clever. I'm now beginning to see why you've made a cheesecake, though, because everything has to be in a paste form for it to work.
Exactly. So a cheesecake was kind of a jumping off point because it's a pretty familiar dessert. It's typically layered and generally has some positive associations for most people, I'd say. So granted, we realized after the fact that we didn't have cheese anywhere in the structure, so perhaps that was an oversight. but yeah, that's kind of the idea.
But at the moment, the technology will only enable you to make a dish where everything either starts off as a paste or can be ground down into a sort of paste which the cartridges can cope with.
Right now, the machine is a little limited in the sense that it works best with pastes and liquids. Basically, anything that can flow through a nozzle can be printed on this machine.
I mean, obviously, 3D printing technology is being used for so many things. People are building rockets, they're building houses, they're building all sorts. So it's perhaps surprising in a way that we haven't heard more about food being created using this sort of thing.
Printing is good for two main things. It's good for uber customization and careful complexity, and also small batch manufacturing. And if you think about what you make and what you do on a daily basis that involves any making, really it's in our kitchen when we're making food at home. So if this were to pervade our lives in a really big way, it would be in our kitchen making us food and kind of, you know, being a nutritionist and a personal chef all in one.
What flavor cheesecake did you go for?
We use graham cracker as a base. So it was graham cracker. We had, you know, peanut butter, Nutella, jam. Nutella was probably my favorite piece in there. But really, it's about combining these ingredients in a unique way that you can localize the flavor and get different flavor sensations, which is really nice.
I can tell I'm talking to an engineer. You see, you've told me how it's constructed. You've told me it looks precise. But what does it taste like?
It tastes good. I mean, what I say is you get out what you put in. So if you start with good ingredients, you're going to get the same kind of quality for the output.
And where does this technology go next?
I think where this is going is it's going to happen in multiple waves. Initially, I'm starting to see this kind of pervade more with companies that are making specific products. So for example, plant-based meat manufacturers who are using this technology to customize the texture, the flavor, in order to mimic animal meat proteins. And then I'm starting to see this also start to move into restaurants for, you know, Michelin chefs and foodies and tinkerers who want to kind of spice up their dish a little bit until people get more comfortable with it. And then it'll start to be in our kitchens.
Jonathan Blutinger at Columbia University in New York. The World Happiness Report is out for the sixth year in a row. The happiest place to live is Finland. It's a slam dunk for Northern Europe, actually, with Denmark and Iceland in second and third place. They looked at things like income, life expectancy, generosity, and perceptions of government corruption. Thomas in Finland told us why he thinks the Finns came out on top.
We're the most equal country. Like, our presidents or central bankers, they shop at the same stores we normal people do. There's no class, really. Women, they have as much or even more say than us men. Like, our current prime minister, she's perhaps the most famous Finn of all time, known for both her tough stance on Russia and her dance moves. We have problems, obviously, but we don't really have that much poverty or homelessness. That's why there aren't many people, some, but not many, who feel they need to take something from others by crime or corruption.
Lots of companies in the tech sector in particular are moving their staff to cities like Helsinki. But Thomas told us we shouldn't imagine that Finns spend their days jumping for joy.
Finns aren't really happy, not in the way the English word happy is meant. It's not elation, it's not joy at living here in the middle of what's basically a large frozen swamp. It's not happiness, it's contentment with our lot. Half of the year we are surrounded by a dark slush and we're okay with that. Because the other half, it's great.
Now, you know we love hearing your favourite sounds. Email globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. Send us a voice note if you can. Esther in Costa Rica says walking over dry, crispy leaves reminds her of her childhood.
Hi, I'm Paige, an American living in Bangkok. When I heard the call for recordings of our favorite sounds, I thought mine is perhaps a bit ASMR, but I knew instantly what it is. I've loved it ever since I was a child, when it was more common to hear. I love the sound of cutting paper, especially when the paper is a little on the thick side, like cardstock. And especially when, in the 1980s at least, that sound was on TV. When I was young and watched children's TV shows, I'd always hoped that they would be making a craft that required them to cut paper.
And Michelle from Michigan in the US likes the sound of her workplace, which is an automotive assembly plant. Michelle says she imagines that she's helping to create a better future because the cars that she makes there are fully electric. Globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Andrew Peach, and still to come.
Some people will be telling me, like, I wouldn't make it to Paris Opera because I was a mixed race or because my feet were flat.
We'll hear more about the new star of French ballet and his roots in Senegal. Doctors on the front line in Ukraine say thousands of lives are being saved by bandages that can stop heavy bleeding in less than a minute. They're coated with an extract which is taken from shrimps and crabs. Ross Mabley is the chief executive of Medtrade, who invented it. He was watching a rugby match when he got a call from the Ukrainian Ministry of Health. Can you tell me a bit more about how this works?
The technology has a base material called chitosan. Chitosan is a derivative of shrimp or crab, so it's from the skeleton of crustaceans. It's a biocompatible and biodegradable non-toxic product that is used actually in a lot of different medical applications, antimicrobial, wound healing. We buy that product in large quantities from the food industry. It's only the outer shell. And then we mix that technology with some of our patented salt and acid compounds to create the Celox technology, which are either granules or they're granules coated onto a gauze. And they are extremely good at hemostasis, better known as stopping bleeding.
Right. So the chitosan, which comes from shrimps and crabs, stops your wound bleeding, which obviously could be useful in many situations, but in a war zone, you can see how that's going to save lives. You know, how does it do that?
The product works extremely quickly. It works independently of the patient's own clotting cascade. And basically what it does, it attracts negatively charged blood cells. So where the bleed site is occurring, so just imagine there's been some sort of gunshot wound or what have you, the product will be applied directly to the site of bleed. The product will then create what's called a pseudoclot by attracting these negatively charged blood cells with a positive charged product, which is Celox, and create this clot. So our product creates that pseudoclot under pressure within 60 seconds. So you can imagine every second counts in a military setting where they're going to be bleeding. Could be a femoral artery bleed, as an example, a very high pressure bleed. We will apply our Celox Rapid product very, very quickly and then stop that bleed.
But I'm just thinking about the applications it might have, you know, that we still get a lot of bleeding leading to death in childbirth, those kind of things around the world. Has it got applications there?
This is our next, let's say, move. We have repurposed this technology to focus on postpartum hemorrhage, as you say. It's strange and crazy to think that postpartum hemorrhage still is a leading cause of maternal mortality in the world. And there were some publications showing that it's even rising in some of the developed nations, the US being one of the worst. Postpartum hemorrhage, for those who don't know, is a failure of the uterus to contract after childbirth. And it affects over 14 million mums a year. And unfortunately, over 80,000 mums actually die because of postpartum hemorrhage. And that's around one mum in every 2 minutes. And we have now followed up doing a clinical evaluation of the product and have found this to be remarkable in stopping bleeding in those instances. So we're seeing about a 95%+ success rate with all mums where we're stopping bleeding in minutes, which is remarkable.
And just finally, Russ, tell me, how does it feel when you get the call from a country that's been invaded saying, we really need tens of thousands of your bandages to stop people bleeding on the battlefield, basically, and you're able to mobilise and do that and make that happen? How does that feel as someone who's behind this technology?
That is the job. It's there to save lives. I'm just proud of the team and everybody supported us in getting that product to the people. And I'm very proud. And, you know, it's great to go to bed at night knowing that we can help.
Russ Mabley from Medtrade. In last week's Happy Pod, we heard about the historic appointment of the son of an immigrant from Senegal as danseur étoile, or principal dancer, at the Paris Opera at the end of a performance in South Korea. This week, let's get more on that story from the man himself, Guillaume Diop, the first person of African heritage to reach this coveted position. He told James Copnell about his journey to the top.
We kind of start working for this since we are like 8 or like 12 when we get into the Paris Opera Ballet School. But it takes, yeah, lots of work and dedication and a lot of determination too.
Did you come from a family where doing ballet was a perfectly natural thing, the kind of thing that a child was likely to do?
No, not really. I mean, my parents weren't like dancers or working in any kind of arts. It wasn't easy for them to understand why I wanted to be a professional dancer, because I feel like they were a bit scared for me that it would be very hard and that it wouldn't be like a real job. So yeah, they kind of discovered the ballet world through me and they tried to trust me even though they were scared, but yeah, they didn't know the ballet world.
They were clearly right to trust you, seeing the success you've had, the glorious reviews I've just been looking at online. Were they right too, though, that it was hard?
Yeah, ballet is really hard. It takes a lot of work, like physically and also mentally. You have to be really like strong to get through all the exams and to work on your body this hard. So yeah, they were kind of right.
And what about as a young mixed race ballet dancer? Did that add an extra complication in the minds of some?
Yeah, before I got into Paris Opera Ballet School, some people would be telling me like I wouldn't make it to Paris Opera because I was a mixed race or because my feet were flat or some things like that. But then when I got into Paris Opera Ballet School, it was actually better because I made it to the School of Paris Opera. So it means it would be fine. There isn't a lot of people of color in Paris Opera, and so there weren't a lot of representation for me to project myself and to see myself in this company. So there was a lot like of thinking for me, wondering if I will be able to make it to Paris Opera, even though I'm not white. So it was a lot of personal thoughts.
Guillaume Diop with James Copnell. At the start of today's episode, we played you this sound. But did you guess it's the sound of a cash machine or an ATM? Drew emailed from the Spanish island of Tenerife to tell us why it's the sound that makes him feel good.
I think, you know, years ago, having gone through university in Bristol, that noise was always a sign that it was going to be a good night. You've promised yourself a week that you're going to be good. And then Friday night comes, everybody's going out and you think, can I afford this? Has that direct debit left the account already? Or, you know, has the overdraft been approved? And just going to the cash point and asking for that cash and then hearing that sound that it's about to cash out to you is just pure joy. I mean, you may have to pay for it next week, but certainly when it pays out, you know you're going to have a great time.
And as someone who's travelled all over, do cash machines sound the same everywhere?
Yeah, they sound the same. I mean, I was in the Philippines for 15 years and there was a time where where money was tight and my parents would maybe help me out now and again, and just hearing that sound would say, okay, there's a bit of love coming from the UK because mum and dad have put 20 quid or 30 quid into my account. But yeah, that sound is the same the world over.
And tell me a bit about the story of your travels, because you've talked about being a student living in the UK, living in the Philippines, living in Spain. Tell us the journey you've been on.
You know, I finished university, got a great job in London, was doing very well. I suppose I got to a point where it just became a bit stagnant, I suppose. So on my 30th birthday, I said, right, I'm going to go for a two-week holiday in the Philippines. 2 weeks later, I woke up with a bit of a hangover and I said, you know what? I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to go home. And that's kind of, that was it. 15 years in the Philippines, finding a great job, building a life, I suppose. And then COVID happened and Asia was just hard hit by COVID. There was a very, very strict lockdown in Philippines. And it was just too much. So my husband and I decided, okay, once this COVID is over, let's move to Europe and start something where we can kind of breathe again.
And why the Spanish island of Tenerife? Why there?
Is that really a question? Why not? It's Tenerife. You know, it's a beautiful place to be.
If you can send us a voice note of the sound that makes you happy, like Drew, globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. Learning to play a musical instrument is well worth the effort, according to scientists, because it can lift your mood and boost your brain power. And if you can't play one already, it's never too late, as Tim McSweeney's been finding out.
Right. See if we can do this in one take.
If you've ever tried to learn a musical instrument, you'll know it can be frustrating at times. Really frustrating. Nah. But if you persevere, eventually, you're rewarded.
Hey, yes!
And now a new study from the University of Bath has shown that learning to play a musical instrument could lift your mood, as well as help train your brain to process sights and sounds, an essential skill for survival.
Hello everyone, I'm Dr. Karin Petrini from the Department of Psychology at University of Bath.
Karin and her colleagues set up an experiment where one group of complete beginners started learning the piano for 1 hour a week. Another group listened to the same kind of music but didn't play. And another control group that did homework or read a book for the same amount of time.
What we saw is that, the cognitive ability to use all this sensory information was much better, significantly better, for the group that played the piano.
So if you think about what happens when you play the piano, for example, you're using your fingers to play the notes, obviously. At the same time, you're reading the music on the page, listening to how it sounds, and using that feedback to change what you're doing with those fingers. It's a full-on multi-sensory experience. And it's something that our brain needs to process and deal with every single day.
Even just when we talk, like I'm talking to you now, like your mouth movement and your facial expression are helping me understanding, but also what you are feeling. So, for example, are you happy so far or what?
Well, what you're saying, it's going really well so far, so don't worry.
But you know yeah. what I mean. Yeah. So that is just one example, and one of that is when you cross a road, and that is really a kind of survival. You know, it could be dangerous if you process this information in the wrong way. Understanding which information needs to be used together to make you a better performer, to make you more aware when it's okay to cross that road, is fundamental. You can imagine how good it is to train with a music instrument and how fun it is, rather than having to do really boring tasks, right, that enhance your cognitive abilities on the computer and repeating it 100 times. Playing an instrument can be so much fun, but has the same results.
And it's not just the multi-sensory training for your brain. Learning to play an instrument could also help reduce depression, anxiety and stress.
Still not got the hang of this bit. Told you.
So should we all be taking up a musical instrument then? Is that what you're saying? Is this a good way of just feeling better about yourself and training your brain?
Any instrument is going to really benefit you in the long term. You might be attracted to the saxophone or to the drums like I am and so on. Just go for it, because it's not the instrument in itself, but is what the instrument trains for you. I don't see any negative side of taking up a music instrument later in life.
Unless you're the neighbour next door.
Yeah.
And someone's banging the drums
at
4 a.m. or something.
I know. We should ask my neighbours for sure.
Note to self to find a bit more time to play the piano. If you were with us for last week's Happy Pod, we talked about words that don't easily translate into other languages.
Hello to the people at the Happy Pod. My name is Jiggy, and I'm from the Philippines. My favorite word in my language is kilig, K-I-L-I-G. It means that sensation of butterflies in your stomach or that tingly feeling in your spine when something romantic or idealistic happens. For example, the teenager was kilig when the boy asked her to dance. Or, I'm so kilig, the BBC published my recording.
That's what we're here for. Thanks to Jiggy. Thanks also to Tamara, Thomas, Esther, Paige, Michelle and Drew for being with us this week. We'd love you to get involved too. So do tell us what you think of this new podcast, or send us a voice note of the sound you love to hear. The email address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. Today's episode was brought to you by Studio Director Ethan Connolly-Forster, producers Olivia Noon and Tracy Gordon, and the editor Karen Martin. My name's Andrew Peach. Thanks for listening. See you next week.